Thank you all so much for joining here tonight. Huge thank you to Notion for lending us their stunning office here. A round of applause for Notion. And in particular, Notion's events and community manager, Emily. Way in back, raise your hand. Thank you, Emily. Round of applause. We're so happy to be here. Tonight is the fifth event in our series, Thursday Nights in AI. Coming soon are folks like Replit CEO Amjad Massad and Quora CEO Adam D'Angelo. So please stay tuned. As context, our intent with this series is to provide folks direct contact with founders and CEOs like Drew. There's so much going on online, but we believe that bringing people together is just a different experience. Getting to meet someone and interact with them and ask them questions is just a different and important experience that we want to facilitate here. This series is co-hosted by Outset Capital and Generally Intelligent. Outset Capital is the fund I run with Ken June and Josh Albrecht. We are backed by the founders of Dropbox, Quora, and Replit. We invest in companies at the earliest stage, so truly idea in a Notion doc stage. And I'm not just saying that because we're here at Notion. We invest pre-seed and seed in AI, deep tech, and the future of work. So if you are building, please come let us know. I am full-time on the fund. Ken June and Josh are not. They are building Generally Intelligent, which is a new AI research company working to develop general purpose AI agents that can be safely deployed in the real world. And hopefully we'll get a little bit more into that during this panel. They are actively hiring. So if you're interested in learning more, please find Ken June or Josh or Matt here from the Generally Intelligent team. And of course, finally, the biggest thank you is to Drew Houston for joining us tonight. Drew doesn't really need an introduction, but we'll do one anyway, just for fun. So Drew is the CEO of Dropbox, which he has led as CEO since he co-founded the company back in 2007. He was actually Ken June's former boss. So Ken June was previously Drew's chief of staff at Dropbox. So they go back a long time. And then in addition to his work at Dropbox, Drew has been on Meta's board of directors since 2020. Quick round of applause for Drew for joining us tonight. One last thing before we kick off. Tonight we're trying something new. We have a QR code up here next to Ken June. If you scan it, that's going to take you to a form where you can submit questions for Drew. So we're going to do 25 minutes of moderated discussion up here, and then we'll open it up to Q&A. So submit your question and your name, and then I'll pick a few and call on those folks to ask the questions directly of Drew. So as you're hearing us talk, as questions come up, make sure to submit the form. All right, with that, let's get started.
Nope. Awesome. Well, thank you for being with us today, Drew. I guess we'll start with, we've talked a lot about the stuff that you're prototyping, and Dropbox recently launched some new products like Dropbox AI and Dropbox Dash and Dropbox Ventures. Have you been surprised by anything with these new product launches, either in the way people are using it or something you discovered that you weren't expecting?
Sure. So first, Ken June, thank you for having me. Ali, Notion, thank you for hosting, and thanks everyone here for coming. So yeah, Dropbox has launched a few things in June. And the first is Dropbox Dash. So basically Dash is AI-powered universal search for all your work stuff, all your cloud stuff. And the origin quickly is, I'm like, what's the version of Dropbox I would build in 2023? I'd probably start in the browser. And in a lot of ways, it's a similar problem. Like I started the company back in 2007. My stuff was everywhere, couldn't find it. Back then, what my stuff was everywhere looked like was I had all these files on all these different devices and different operating systems that didn't talk to each other. And the solution looked like syncing all your files to the cloud. And then with Dash, the problem is still like my stuff's everywhere, can't find it. Like how often do we have that experience where we got our 100 tabs across the top and we got, I know I was looking at this document yesterday or an hour ago, and I think I'm typing in an exact keyword match into the Chrome search button and it's not finding it. So like all these little paper cuts like that. So basically building the missing organizing layer for all your cloud stuff. So Dash lets you search not just your files, but all your cloud content, your Google Docs, your Notion Docs, all your communication channels, Slack, your email, everything. And it's an example of something where it's like, when you look at the overall system or just there's all the fragmentation of tools, basic experiences like search can actually be like worse today than 20 years ago. If you think about it, like 20 years ago, you want to find something, you just search your hard drive. It's there, or your email, and it's there, it's not. But then we've ended up in this world kind of new problem where it's like I have 10 search boxes that each search 10% of my stuff, but then I have to run search 10 times. And there are a bunch of other issues we could talk about with just the way content that we manage our stuff at work. But to launch Dropbox Dash into closed beta, the reception's been good so far. It's very early. We're just continuing to iterate on the experience and getting ready to tune our growth and monetization and all that. We also launched Dropbox AI. So our internal code name for it was FileGPT. So kind of as it sounds, basically, if you have a big PDF or you have a big slide deck, or if you have a big video, actually, because we will transcribe all videos and you can basically search, ask questions of your content or do things like summarize kind of the usual things you'd expect. And then we also launched a venture fund, Dropbox Ventures, to get more involved in the community of startups and kind of the Cambrian explosion of innovation that's happening. And then lastly, I think biggest surprise, maybe it's not so much with our launches, but just sort of in the world, certainly a kind of ChatGPT being like the iPhone launch moments of the AI era. I mean, we could debate the degree how surprising the technology would take to mature or when we'd actually see AI, but then just like the interest, the way AI has captured everybody's imagination in the last 7 or 8 months was a pleasant surprise. And then another pleasant, so from a Dropbox perspective, a surprise was just the magnitude of the opportunity. I think when you use something like ChatGPT, I think it's pretty amazing all the things it can do, but you realize pretty quickly there's whole categories of questions that ChatGPT and kind of generic AI can't answer because it's not personalized. So if you ask ChatGPT, like, what's my passport number again? Or like, where was the launch deck from last year for the spring launch then? Or things like that. Like, it can't answer because it's not connected to your information. And so
perhaps a good thing that it can't answer that one.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm sure we'll get into that. But the opportunity in front of us to build personalized AI where you can be connected to your data in a secure and trustworthy way and help folks with that and help people make sense of their working life more broadly and build more of a self-organizing Dropbox. There's all these frontiers that have opened up. So early, but really excited.
What about anything surprising in terms of like hypotheses you had about what users would find interesting or not interesting and that turned out to be true or false?
Yeah, so it's still pretty early. Like, we haven't scaled this up to kind of like millions of users yet. I mean, what's good is I think first is just like people get the problem. When I sort of talk about, and I think they get the problem in a more visceral way than they might have even a couple of years ago. And then certainly after COVID, you know, now that we're putting a lot more stress on the system, on our screens, I think people get it. And so I think often people are like, well, can I use it now? So that's that, you like to see that. And then surprises, you know, we're continuing to sand down all the rough edges in the onboarding, having to connect all your different apps is kind of a pain. So we're finding ways to streamline that. But not yet. No, I mean, we're still pretty early in the whole journey to scale.
And then I think you've also, in addition to releasing products just very quickly, have been prototyping yourself and kind of hacking yourself.
Yeah, I think this is actually one of your superpowers as a founder CEO, which is, Drew, despite running a giant company that has a lot of revenue, who hacks all the time and like showed me his prototype for his like crazy speech to writing app. So tell us a little bit about some of the stuff you've been prototyping, what you've been learning from that.
Yeah. So I guess a little background. So I started out as, you know, that little kid, and there's like a PC Junior in my living room, this like glowing screen and all these buttons, and fell in love immediately for life. I started out playing computer games, but then learning to code to write my own computer games. I thought I was going to be a career game developer. That was actually my first programming job. I've always been an engineer. That's always like my first calling. And then I knew I wanted to be a startup founder of some kind. Didn't know I wanted, and I wasn't sure about being a CEO. They sort of like backed into that.
Yeah, I remember you have a quote that's like, the journey from founder to CEO is from engineer to therapist.
Yeah, engineer to therapist, engineer to politician, engineer. It's, you know, there's a lot of different hats. But when you get that job, or when you inhabit the job of a CEO or an executive or even a manager, probably a lot of things that we all have to navigate, there's a lot of repetitive shit. And I'm like, man, I really don't enjoy the process of doing all these like manual things over and over again. So all along, but certainly in the last several years, I've been trying to find new ways to automate my job, like in a serious way. So, and then in 2016, probably 7 years ago, I really wanted to better understand machine learning for a lot of reasons. I got a computer science degree, but I didn't really specialize in machine learning or wanted to go to grad school, got distracted with startups, things like that. But Yeah, I really was interested in like, what's the theory of machine learning? How does it actually work? Writing code, I mean, doing things like trying to use, just write little scripts to triage my email and try to figure out which of all my overflowing inbox, which of these things, which of these emails like has a request or which ones are important in some definition, which ones have some kind of invitation, what do I need to respond to, not respond to. I use machine learning to classify my calendar, so figure out where my time goes, kind of build like Mint for your time. And then the list goes on and on. And so, yeah, I think there have been these like breakthrough, or every time there's like a new era of computing, some of them come with really interesting engineering, not all of them, but some of them. So I remember learning to code as a kid, and then the internet comes around, learning about networking, and then learning about distributed systems later as the cloud was coming up. And then things like mobile, of course, but like from an engineering standpoint, mobile wasn't, it was sort of like the same general engineering principles, but then as you have machine learning and then large language models and AI, like these were like really new, there's like painting with new colors, right? And machine learning just, you know, you take that computer science class or your algorithms class, and it's like the human writes the algorithm and then the computer calculates the answers. And then machine learning kind of inverts that, where it's like, well, actually the human gives the answers and the machine basically figures out an algorithm to figure out what you want. And then large language models being like cognition in a bottle. So I just find it, and I find it really helpful. First, I love this stuff. Like I love engineering, coding. I write thousands of lines of code a year still, not in production, but like from prototyping. And then, yeah, just like trying to figure it, I think it really helps me be grounded and build conviction around like what's real, what's hype, do these things actually work?
Yeah, what do you feel like is real and what's hype based on what you've been prototyping?
Well, I think like, I mean, I find it helpful. There's not a lot of good things about getting older. So I just turned 40. But like you do get some perspective from having seen multiple cycles, right? The dot-com thing was happening. It was like just finishing high school, entering college, and the iPhone launched right after I graduated. And the cloud AWS launched in 2006. Like those things made Dropbox possible. So I think what everybody is sorting through is like the promise of AI is, well, first of all, people have been predicting what it can do for a long time, more or less correctly. And then when the internet came along, people had all these ideas, like you'll be able to do this, you'll be able to communicate, you'll have all these Star Trek kind of things. And like broadly, they like came true, but often they came true like 10, 20 years after. Like some came through immediately, like search engines and things like that. Some things took 10 or 20 years. So that's kind of the lens I look at large language models through. Like in a lot of things, you have these like amazing demos, but then certainly anybody building with AI is like thinking, it's like it's easy to make the demo, but then how do you scale these things up to production? How do you make them reliable? How do you make them secure? Things like that. And then the markets, like who's going to pay for what? Like what's the whole value chain going to look like? And then are there any traps? Like I think people have been excited about self-driving, you know, 10 years ago. And like only now do you really have cars really like driving around the streets here without a driver in them. So that's sort of the kind of prism I look at this through. But I think it's something like a lot of cool demos, but then no more discernment needed to figure out what can really scale.
Anything you think is hype that you wanna call out or no?
Oh, I mean,
anything you think is really real, like yeah.
Yeah,
I think your workflow is really cool.
I think it's like it's amazing about the large language models. I think it's like 10 breakthroughs like in one thunderclap, and I think it helps me to kind of like try to slow down the tape and be like, there were a lot of things that just happened with that thing. So talking about like triaging my inbox, right? For most of the history of computing, like computers couldn't really parse a sentence, like in English. Like as soon as you got a blob of text, especially like malformed text, like that humans usually generate, it's very hard for a computer to make sense of it. And like conventional NLP or natural language processing information retrieval was like pretty limited. It was like very hard to get to like take a paragraph in an email and be like, here's what the person wants, or here's the date or things like that. So a large language model can like parse text. Then like after that, it can also read and understand text and or understand meaning. It can then generate text. It can code. It knows about the world and has like theory of mind type things. It can do like creative tasks like that would have been reserved for arts. I mean, there's like literal Stable Diffusion kind of art, but then also just like poetry or jokes. Like any one of those would have been considered like a breakthrough that would have kept us busy for like 5 years, but they all happen at the same time. And there's all the multimodal stuff. So something I'm very excited about is the combinations of all these things, right? And so, you know, now you basically can take a 500 line JavaScript file, paste it into a large language model and have it write a sonnet about it. Like, that's possible. And then, yeah, Jim Phan, who I've gotten a little bit, like, teaching, like, computers learning to play Minecraft and, like, writing their own code to develop their own skills and then play Minecraft better than any human could. Like, this is the world we now live in. So I think it's, like, very real. I think finding some things are, like, more difficult than they look, like, you know, truly building autonomous agents and training them, like, that's like a hard problem, or, you know, the naive attempts to do that are pretty limited. You could tell me more than I know about it. But I think we're all kind of fumbling through that. It's sort of like the Amazon guy dropped off this alien artifact of a large language model, and we're all kind of kicking it and poking it and seeing what noises it makes. Like, it's a really cool time.
You have some really interesting specific, like, ideas about ways in which you can use these for organizations. So one of the things you talked about was like auto Drew for your team. Drew pitched this idea of, as CEO, I'm like often asking my team questions when they come to me with like, this is my plan. And the questions are basically the same questions. It's like, did you think about like, what's the timeline? Did you think about who the stakeholders are? Did you get buy-in? Did you think about like, what is the impact on the user? And you're like, I feel like I could make a Drew bot that my team could just talk to, and they would ask, it would ask these questions. What are some of your ideas for automating your job with AI, with language models, and et cetera?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, a good starting point is if you think about SaaS, right, or the cloud, pretty much every tool you were using before that, or like a, you know, desktop app or something, like quickly had like the cloud version of that, which made the non-cloud version of it like seem very archaic and limited. So I think any tool we use today, we're using the dumb version. And people are either building the smart versions or making the dumb version smart. So pretty much anything, you're like, okay, email, what would smart email look like? What would smart calendar look like? What would smart document look like? So I think that's a very like basic way to do it. Yeah, to your point, I use AI or large language models a lot for writing. And I wired up Whisper, like the audio transcription. And so I use this like every day. Like this morning, I was babbling into my computer, and then it makes a very raw transcript, and I have one pass that cleans up the transcript and makes it a little more coherent, and then, you know, back and forth to outlines and this sort of this bizarre or this peculiar writing process that's very much assisted by large language models. Any kind of repetitive task, right? But then also it's gonna be interesting to see the roles that AI inhabits in our working lives. We've heard the co-pilot metaphor or the messaging metaphor for a chatbot. But I think the roles are really interesting. AI will not only be like this oracle or answering questions and things like that, but also like a coach, right? Or a mentor, like way better to your point. Usually I'm not giving like super remedial feedback in a meeting, but sometimes we'll be like, all right, if you're writing a business case, there are like 50 things we care about. It's like pretty cognitively difficult to keep all 53 things in your head, but like that's no problem for a computer. So they can kind of check through using large language models to check anything where you need a lot of conscientiousness and discipline and detail orientation. LLMs are going to be like, and computers generally are going to be like really good at that. And so I think I'm really interested in like, all right, you know, it's 2030. How do we re-segment knowledge work so that our human processor can be doing human things and the silicon brain can be doing the other half of the things? And we've done that in computing with CPUs and GPUs and things like that. But like we're sort of in an environment where we just invented this other kind of processor, this like silicon brain. And now we need to figure out what we can offload to it. Because there's a lot of human tasks that really should be done by computers. Even starting with the word computer used to refer to a human. It was a person, like in the 1600s. Like this is someone who would like literally carry out calculations by hand all day. But then as we had all these different kinds of machine help, not the industrial revolution, we got a lot of physical leverage. But then cognitively, we invented all these tools to offload our brain tasks, and computing went from being a person thing, like a human verb to a machine verb. So I think a lot about what verbs are going to make that transition, right? Like organizing should go from being something that like humans do, where we're all like filing things away, and to something that machines do for us. And, you know, there's a lot more verbs than that.
Yeah. I'm curious where you see the value of AI accruing. You are a hacker, a founder, but you're also now a Fortune 500 CEO. Running a...
We're not quite Fortune 500. Okay, but
public company, founder,
we're
CEO.
We're in some like longer, like S&P 400, which sounds more... It's,
I like
it's
it.
Smaller.
It's running smaller. An S&P Mid-cap 400 company. And now you kind of have distribution. You have, I forget, 700, how many users right now?
700 million registered
700
users.
700 million registered users. 20
million
That's incredible.
18 million subscribers, yeah.
So you have distribution, and obviously you're running to add AI features on top of your existing product. So that's kind of one way that incumbents can maybe benefit from this stuff by adding on to existing products. And then a lot of the folks in this room, and that I'm sure you talk to, and maybe now invest in through Dropbox Ventures, are just starting out, and they're starting out AI forward. They don't have an existing product. It's really kind of built from the ground up on AI. And so I'm curious where you see the value going. Is it mostly to the incumbents that can add features onto existing products and onto existing distribution? Do you think these new generative AI capabilities are enough to build whole new products? I'm curious your thoughts there.
Yeah. So where my head goes is some of it's like theory and academic stuff, like Clay Christensen, Disruptive Innovation, a great book called The Innovator's Dilemma. It's like classic. I highly recommended reading for everyone here, any founder. And he talks about some of this. He's like, there's sustaining innovation and there's disruptive in it. Sustaining innovation is where you're like taking an existing thing and you're just making it like better, faster, cheaper, whatever. And a lot of what AI does is that, to the extent that you can summarize text, like Google Docs is probably going to, and Notion is going to do that. That's sort of a sustaining innovation, sort of same product, same customer, same business model, pretty easy to adopt. But then disruptive innovation is different in that it's like something that makes life difficult for the incumbent, right? And there are a lot of classic examples of this. I mean, the iPhone was disruptive, right? In all kinds of ways, but like compared to the old, using like a computer operating system in a phone and all these other things. But then disruptive innovation can also happen in tech in maybe not obvious ways. So like something like Snap, right? So ephemeral messaging where it's private, the messages disappear versus like WhatsApp or Messenger, like it's hard to have both like public and private messaging at the same time, right? So you sort of make your competitor fork their product. So I think there's like things like that. So things where it's like you make the existing thing better, and it's just, I think AI is going to accrue a lot of value, or the incumbents are going to benefit from that. But what I'm really excited about are the things that are like AI native. Like every time you have a new era, there's like, you know, mobile native apps where, you know, again, using Facebook as an example, Facebook was able to sort of take Facebook.com and put it in a mobile app pretty well. But then things like Instagram or Snap are like, you could only do that on a phone. Like there was no, that couldn't have existed in the same, or Uber couldn't have existed in the same way before that. And so I think ChatGPT is, we'll see how disruptive it is, right? But that it, you could make the argument, and certainly people are making the argument, that search is going to be disrupted because it's a lot more convenient for certain kinds of tasks. I don't need to like go through a Google search and Wikipedia and you know, rabbit hole to figure out what I want. Or if I'm planning a trip, like it can do a great job of that for me. And then it's like, that's disruptive innovation because, you know, you're disintermediating Google or a search engine. No one really knows, like, is that a big disruption, little disruption? And then what also makes it disruptive is not just the product experience or the difference in product, but also the business model, right? So the 10 blue links, auction, like that stuff kind of goes away, or at least becomes different in a messaging context. It's hard to sort of present both interfaces at the same time if you're Google to respond, right? Because you're like, well, it's a search engine and links, but then do we have to switch into like conversation mode, and how does that work?
Where do the ads go?
So those are the kinds of those AI native, or, you know, era native experiences I think are going to be super interesting. We're seeing, you know, the chatbot interface, like messaging a machine was not a thing we were doing before AI in the same way. These co-pilot experiences, but there's a lot of other metaphors we're going to discover.
Yeah, one of the things I've been thinking about is chat as a new media platform, like new media medium, like TV. Yeah. You know, or web, like chat. Now other people can put in content into a chat interface. And it's kind of interesting to think about it that way, like in terms of disruptive innovation.
I was going to say, like, and yeah, and there's like all this early signal that these like AI companions of different forms or like characters, that's like a thing, like that's going to bend the curve of humanity in an interesting direction. But like that couldn't have existed before AI. So it's definitely going to be like one category. So yeah, there'll be a lot of these that we discover.
What about moats? So there are some people who argue foundation models have no moat. And then some people say foundation models are the only ones who have a moat. Do you have any opinions on where you think the moats will be?
Yeah. I mean, when you think about like, where will the value accrue? You can sort of think of it in the value chain, you know, top to bottom too. So I think folks who own the customer relationship, so if you're presenting the interface, then that gives you a lot of advantages. And that's what we believe, kind of the application layer. Because if you're the thing they're looking at, then you control, to some extent, like all the steps that happen after that, or all those layers in the stack below. I think you could see a lot, or like aggregators in general have a lot of power. So like Kayak or Flight Search, none of them operated an airline, but they were able to capture some of the value and create value by getting in front of the customer and being like, here's a simpler way to do this than like logging into 10 airlines. So I think you'll definitely have the top of the stack, whoever owns the customer, and then the bottom of the stack, I mean, NVIDIA. So like the hardware, like NVIDIA has sort of a monopoly right now on like the kinds of GPUs that we need to train these big models, but we can debate how long that's going to last. I mean, I think large language models do have commodity, like foundation models have commodity characteristics because they're easy to swap out to some extent. I mean, it's a matter of degree. It's not a binary like one or zero, but it's like the API is literally like text in, text out. They're different dimensions. So not that all foundation models are created equal. So you have different size, so costs, latency, like IQ, like you know, quality, context length, specialized models, like what Bloomberg was doing or medical or and so on. So you can differentiate on a bunch in a bunch of ways, but then LLMs have a particularly tricky thing where you can use their outputs to distill or bootstrap your in-house model. So it's sort of like you give the blueprints of the model to some degree just by putting the results out there. So I think that makes it easier or makes it hard to have like switching costs and durability in a way. So I think in the middle, yeah, the foundation model, we'll see, but I would say that that's like very, they're also not that expensive to train. Like you can train them in like $10 million is a lot of money, but like there's a lot of companies that have 10 million. And then, you know, what we taking this to our Dropbox 1.0 experience, we're hoping like, oh yeah, you can build this. We're going to build this like platform and this developer ecosystem. And we kind of had the same issue. It's like, well, it's Dropbox, the API was not really like an operating system. Like you open a thing and you save a thing and you list things and that's kind of it. And then there wasn't that much lock-in because like what ended up happening is you'd be like, all right, well, you want to open something from the cloud? Like here's the hamburger menu of like of Dropbox and OneDrive and Google Drive and Box and everything. And it ended up not being like a source of lock-in for us. And then like we also experienced this land grab, which is definitely happening now where like folks know that the winners are going to be chosen the next couple of years and first mover advantage. And they know how they're going to subsidize things, sell some of these capabilities below cost to get share. So like all that stuff's going to happen. So I think it's going to be pretty, it's already pretty kind of bloody in the foundation model space. If you can be the number one on those domains, if you can be the cheapest or like the easiest to use or like the highest quality results or whatever else, if you can durably hold that land, you can generate a lot of value. But otherwise, yeah, I think like my engineer training was helpful for some things, but then sort of my business training on the job ended, you know, is another important lens you need to add.
One of the things I was wondering is, so you're on the board of Meta and you look at these, you know, Fortune 500 companies and Dropbox has a lot of enterprise customers. Like, what do you think of Meta's open source Llama strategy?
Yeah, so I can talk about it kind of with my Dropbox hat on. Dropbox was a launch partner and the Llama 2 launch. I think it's super exciting. Open sourcing a great, really high quality foundation model then allows the whole army of open source contributors to make it better. And you already saw community building with Llama 1. And it's amazing what's happened in the last few months. I mean, you can run now like a 70 billion parameter model. Like I run my gaming PC and I hacked in adding a Thunderbolt extension card and another GPU under my desk. And so I can run Llama 2, like the big one, using, if you quantize a model, you can run it in 48 gigs of VRAM. Anyway, like, I think it's like, you know, we'll see, but it's a lot like, you know, when people want to have a website back in the day, they used to have to buy like Microsoft's like internet information server or Netscape's proprietary. You know, that knows what I'm talking about. And so like, you know, so there's the proprietary offerings first, and then along came Linux and open source. And then the shared ingenuity of the world made these things a lot better. And so I think we're already seeing the same kind of explosion and innovation in the open source community, and like the price performance of how much it costs to like do inference at scale just keeps coming, like improving 10x, 10x, 10x. It's like many Moore's law type things happening simultaneously.
Speaking of open source, Alice N, do you want to ask, stand up and ask your question? Alice is here. Nope. Okay. Final call. Nope. All right. Okay. Well, I know this is going to get Kanjun chatting as well. So Jim Fan, you want to ask your question?
Hi, Drew. I'm Jim Fan from NVIDIA. So I just have one question. What do you think of the role of AI agents in enterprise settings?
AI agents in enterprise setting. I'm super excited about it. I'm super curious for Kanjun's sake too, because you're working in this world. I think in the long run, no question, we're going to have the agent model or having these chat type experiences where you not just get answers, but you know, one of the silver linings of COVID is like now AIs, because we sort of digitized all of work, LLMs or agents are going to be able to basically operate with the same rights and privileges as humans, or they're just another remote worker from one way of looking at it. So I think it's super exciting. It's all, you know, people have been tinkering with all these things. I think sort of like, oh, we'll just like throw like elaborate layers of band-aids and hacks on GPT-4. I think you need a little more than that. Or folks who have done that, like the agents get confused easily, and it's, you know, we'll see whether it's just like there needs to be a couple breakthrough approaches. Your work is super interesting on this. But so is it that? Do we just have to figure a couple of things out? Or is this something like self-driving where you can sort of get 80% of the way there, but like getting it to be totally, you know, perfect will take time. I mean, it's very different from self-driving because the stakes are lower and there's more 80-20 type things. And I'm going to, yeah.
It's Kanjun, much easier think? Than a lot
much
of ways.
Easier. Yeah. Abba, what do you think?
Oh man, you put me on the spot. Agents in enterprise settings. And I think agents are the future. Like people talk about generative AI, they're very excited about it. And I think generative AI is cool, but also, when I write an essay, I don't just output an essay word by word and then say, I'm done. I look at the essay, I critique it. I think, I don't like the intro. I should go do some more research. Someone wrote a paper recently. I'm going to incorporate what they said. I'm going to rewrite the outline. Like this kind of iterative process, even that is, you know, more than just generative. And so I think thinking about agents, like most of the value, I think, will accrue to agents. In, let's say we're in 2040, we're gonna see like agents are running everything. And I don't personally think of agents as these like autonomous things running around. I kind of think of them as like a new type of computer or like an upgrade to my computer, where like my computer now has these programming primitives that are able to deal with like much fuzzier situations. I mean, I'm sure you also think about this, so. But yes. And in enterprises, lots of work could be done by agents.
All right, Jessica Rosenfield, if you're here, stand up.
Yeah. Hi, I am Jessica Rosenfield. And my question is how you go about road mapping these big ambitious visions with the evolving state of the art if things are just changing so rapidly that you might make an investment in something that doesn't matter in 9 months.
Yeah. So the way we do it, first you need like a portfolio approach, right? So of like singles, doubles, home runs, more speculative ideas, more predictable ideas, more disruptive ideas, more sustaining ideas, and sort of think of it in terms of baskets that way. I think also like given that dynamic where like you can kind of predict, it's sort of easier actually to figure out what's going to be there in 10 years than like in 12 months for some things. So like working back from an end, trying to do the exercise of like, all right, it's 2030. I open my laptop. What does that look like? Or list all the tools I use. They're all dumb today. What would smart look like? You know? So I think there's a bunch. I don't think there's one way to do it. I think there's a lot of ways to do it. And then for incubating a lot of these ideas, we've built our own like internal Y Combinator. Basically, it's very much modeled after that. We take a small team, 2-3 people, and let them rip. And sometimes these are ideas that the kind of company or I want to see explored. Sometimes it's what they want to do. Sometimes it's more of these blue sky exercises. So a little of everything. And then we kind of plan on all horizons. We sort of take a very long view of like, all right, here's what the future is. And then we do like a 3-year strategy, which we just did. And then we look on a 1-year plan. We're starting the whole 1-year plan thing. Big company stuff. But I think, yeah, putting some structure around it and like making a lot of small investments, doubling down on what works and things like that.
Is there a name for this internal YC? File GPT is so good that I'm like very confident in your naming abilities.
So the little incubator is called AMP. It stands for Augmented Management Products.
I like it. I like it.
And so, yeah, and it was before LLM. So we've been working on this for a while.
All right, we'll do two last questions. Aaron L. Aaron, do you mind standing up, please?
Hi, I'm Aaron. Thanks for the talk. Very informative. My question was kind of related to your point about you wanting to study machine learning. I'm curious from your perspective, given that, you know, AI is becoming more and more commoditized, and it seems like even fine-tuning is becoming commoditized. Is there a point to building up ML expertise from your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think for the same reasons it helps. I grew up coding and just hacking my way through high school, but then like studying computer science formally, studying distributed systems formally, like that experience was what made building something like Dropbox possible. Because I think you need both have the theory and the applied skill set. And if you're missing one or the other, if it's all theory and you can't build anything, like one problem. But then if you're just tinkering and screwing around but don't know how these things work, you have a different problem. I mean, I think there's a big shift where AI is a lot more accessible. I don't think AI is necessarily commoditized yet. I think we're all figuring out what these things can do. And like Llama 2 just came out a few weeks ago. And like with Llama 2, that's like the first time that most people can actually even try to fine tune a large model, because OpenAI doesn't yet let you fine tune the larger models. And so anyways, there's a lot of stuff that's just turned on in the last few weeks, which is like what one of the things that's really exciting about it. But I think knowing the theory of like, okay, how do these like autoregressive models work? What's the math? Building that into it, in addition to the tinkering, like what do these things actually do in real life? If they start going off the rails, or you want to know what's possible, the grounding in the theory is super, super important. I'm not like by any stretch like an ML researcher or something, but like I also find that if you read the paper, like reading the papers are like pretty readable or more readable than you might think. And then if you just do it for a while, like the first time I was reading these things, I'm like, I like me some Greek letters and integral signs and sigmas, but like, fuck, this is like really impenetrable. But like, if you do it for like 5 years, you actually can, I still skip past a lot of the notation, but I'm like, okay, I sort of see what they're getting.
Just look at the graphs. Every paper needs some theory, but it's just fake.
But through ChatGPT?
Well, actually, that's another, yes, you can, GPT-4 will happily tell you what all these things mean. That's an excellent point. But one thing that has certainly happened in the last 12 months is that the baton's been kind of passed from the research frontier to the tinkerers and the builders. There's a ton more to do on the research side, but the point being, like, it used to be the limiting factor. We just didn't have algorithms or methods that would let you build intelligence into your products. Now, like, the research has done a great job of like way outpacing the builders, and now we're like, what the hell do we do with these things?
All right, one last question, since we're obviously at time. Dina Irlan.
Hi, my name is Dina. Thanks for the talk. Just interested in your early days building Dropbox. How did you achieve conviction? And what is your advice to, you know, build conviction in your ideas?
Build conviction. Well, my playbook entrepreneurially has always been just like get super frustrated by a problem and just want and eradicate it. So how did Dropbox get started? Like I just kept forgetting my thumb drive. I was like, why am I emailing? I'm like writing emails to myself and like hitting the paperclip and attaching a file and receiving them. Like, what is this? I tried all the other products, but like they didn't work under stress, like they would fall down. And so I think there are pros and cons of that. I think the pros are it's like easy to build like conviction and passion. And I'm like, look, I wasn't even thinking about Dropbox as like a company in the early stages. I was just like, I just never want to have this problem again. And I'm like, it was a bus ride where I forgot my thumb drive. I open up, I'm like, shit, now I can't do any work for the next 5 hours. So I'm going to start coding and try to never have this problem again. And then for me, that just happened over and over again. It's like, oh, I hate having an inbox that has this many emails and I don't know what I'm supposed to be like, da, 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 and, or like, I don't know where my time goes, or like, God, there's all this stuff. There's been all this, these advancements in like semantic search and NLP and large language models. And like, why is search so dumb on my browser? And so for me, now you can have pitfalls where it's like, you are not necessarily your customer. And so like, when there's a big difference, you can get yourself in trouble that way. But, you know, I think it starts with just like finding problems you can get obsessed with. And then, you know, I get frustrated by technology pretty easily. And so fortunately, like for every problem technology solves, it like creates a new problem. So it's sort of this like evergreen source of new stuff to work on.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Drew, for chatting with us. We have a lot of builders in the audience and it's just great to hear your journey and your continuing journey. You know, you're always innovating. I know that also internally within Dropbox, you inspire a lot of people to go and start their own companies. Kanjun, being one of them, but also one of many. I think you have maybe like 25 or more.
We definitely have a mafia.
Yeah, like a whole Dropbox mafia founders, many of which are unicorns, public companies, Vanta, Material Security, many, many more. So thank you for sharing your thoughts with us and hanging out also for a bit after this. And also thank you all for coming and joining us. And we hope to see you next time. And so big round of applause for Drew.